here we are. Sharon is talking to Steve. This is it. There's nothing else. But there's everything, meaning that in any given moment, that's a fresh chance to ask ourselves, who do I want to be? What do I want to do? What do I want to give? And act and pivot accordingly. This moment can be that little point that with the slightest shift of intention or change of action or word spoken in the aggregate across time can change everything.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Hey, hey, I'm Steve Norris. Welcome to Better Place Project, where each week we shine a light on amazing humans from every corner of the planet who are doing extraordinary things to help make the world a better place, including sharing their knowledge with us on how we can be living healthier, happier, more purposeful lives. Hey, everybody, welcome to episode 93. First off, before I get started, thank you all for the wonderful notes and messages you've sent regarding last Friday's Feel Good Friday episode. For those that don't know, every Friday I do just a really short 5 to 10 minute episode telling a feel good or inspirational story. And last Friday's episode was extra special because I told the story of a hero named Patrick Cadigan, who gave his life to save a young woman back in 1909. And that man happened to be my great-great-grandfather. So I'm just a little bit proud. So if you want to check out an FFG that's a little extra special for me, go give that a listen. It's only 5 minutes. But I am literally hopping with excitement over today's guest. Seriously, guys, can you hear me? I am literally jumping in my studio with my headphones on. I am so excited about today's guest. Aaron, tell us who we've got today.
For over 25 years, Sharon LaBelle's internationally best-selling book, The Art of Living, the classic manual on virtue, happiness, and effectiveness, has inspired philosophy lovers in the modern Stoicism movement. Sharon is a strong proponent of expressing philosophy in accessible language so anyone can apply it to better their own lives and be invited to delve further into philosophical inquiry. Since Sharon LaBelle was a child, she was obsessed with the questions, how do we each live the best possible life and what does that mean? She has since spent her life writing and speaking about philosophy, spirituality, meditation, Buddhism, Judaism, ethics, feminism, and related topics. She is also the author of Naming Ourselves, Naming Our Children, and co-author of The Music of Silence.
Whether you've come across Sharon LaBelle or not, you are in for a treat. Not only is she an international best-selling author, philosopher, spiritual leader, as Aaron said, but she's also an incredible musician and songwriter, and she wrote the music, by the way, that you heard at the very beginning of this episode. And we talk about that very unique stringed instrument that she's playing there. But most importantly, Sharon and I chatted about philosophy, the meaning of life. I loved this section, by the way. What she's learned and teaches about Stoicism, the importance of radical caring, learning what you can do with a moment. And I promise you'll walk away with some great ideas on how we can shift our perspective and, as she says, start living as if our life depended on it. And now, my conversation with Sharon LaBelle.
Make the world a better place. Make the world a better place.
Welcome to the show, Sharon. How are we doing?
I'm thrilled to be with you, with everyone who's listening.
And I think I'm speaking for everyone. We are absolutely thrilled to have you as well, Sharon, for sure. I've been so looking forward to this conversation. And my only concern is, can we get to everything that I want to get to today? So I have so many things I want to pick your brain about. But can we start by you sharing with us a little bit about your childhood and the path you took that led you to become an author, philosopher, and spiritual leader?
Sure. Well, I was one of those oddball introverted kids. And I happened to live across the street from a philosopher from India named Narayan Champawat. And he taught at the local college. And I didn't know what philosophy was as a kid, but when I would go over to his house to play with his children, basically the furniture of his house was books. And I just thought, this is home. Anyway,
So you were an avid book reader, I'm assuming then? You loved books as a child?
Oh, yeah. They were my friends, my
your sanctuary.
Refuge. Yeah, exactly. My sanctuary. And so one day, Professor Champawat saw that I wasn't particularly engaged with whatever the other kids were doing. And he just started talking to me. And I asked him, what is philosophy? And, you know, because all the other in those days, dads on the block work, you know, I understood what their work was, but philosophy, you're a philosopher?
Sure.
And he said, well, philosophy is the love of wisdom. And if you're interested, I'll give you a book about it. And so I must have been, I can't say for sure, but maybe 11 years old, 12 years old, something like that.
Not many 11-year-olds are learning about philosophy. That's pretty stinking cool.
Well, it didn't feel that cool back then, I'll tell you. But yeah. Anyhow.
I was playing around in the mud at 11 years old, by the way, going,
dude. You sound better adapted.
That more prepared me possibly for the real world, maybe playing around in the mud. Yeah.
Yes. I've got to make up for lost time.
Well, in my case, ignorance was bliss, I think. Yeah.
Anyway, long story short, I think he gave me what was essentially, an introductory book to philosophy for, say, a freshman in college. And it was a big doorstop of a thing. But I took it home and I read it. And I there's no way that I understood very much of it. But words would jump out at me, you know, existentialism and what does it mean to be? And then I would think, wow, it is kind of amazing that we exist, you know, because maybe, it seems like the odds are that we weren't. Anyway, it just got my wheels turning. And so that kind of sensitized me to, just the fundamental questions of life. I guess I still feel this way of being in the world to this day, that I see people going about their daily business and taking whatever's in front of them seriously and engaging in it. And I just always think, kind of what a miracle it is that any of this is happening. And I don't know, I guess that's sort of the spirit that has
very
formed
cool.
my life.
So then as a follow-up question, what was it that eventually led you to the Greek philosopher Epictetus and the teaching of Stoicism?
Okay, well, definitely, I was a child of the 60s and the 70s. And so I definitely went through my existentialism phase. And on the heels of that, a conviction, however inarticulated, started to coalesce within me. And that was simply the idea that whatever a good life is, it has to be looked at through a moral lens. Now, mind you, not a sanctimonious lens, not a thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that lens, but just it seemed to me that any sense of being a whole person had to do with inclining one's life toward seeing the good, enacting the good, leaning into the good, making good choices. And so I guess it was when I was a young mother in the late 80s, early 90s, I just started reading Marcus Aurelius, and then I found out about this guy, Epictetus, whose name I couldn't pronounce. No one could pronounce it because no one had heard of him back then except for academics. And I came upon Epictetus's discourses in translation. And, I should say parenthetically, like all people of my generation, I of course had my, you know, I was at the spiritual buffet. I practiced Zen. I practiced Tibetan Buddhism, a little of this, a little of that. And in saying a little of this, a little of that, I don't mean to, you know, kind of trivialize it or, oh, sure, that was just a phase. But, you know, I was exploring like so many. And when I came upon Epictetus's discourses, it was just like treasure. It's like, why aren't people talking about this? What's going on here?
Just and grabbed you.
It yeah. really grabbed me. And ironically, this was a time when there was a lot of unspoken, in the zeitgeist, there was a kind of antipathy to, you know, dead, do we have to hear another dead white man and what he has to say? You know, and the whole idea of Western philosophy, it was, you know, everyone wanted to do Taoism. Everyone wanted to do Buddhism at that time because there was a sense that that was more expansive or something in one's mind, and that Western philosophy was somehow too rigid, too binary in its thinking. But I thought this was good stuff. So I started a kind of self-study, I guess you'd call it, because nobody was around to talk about this.
Sure. You were out there on your own. You followed your heart and went with what resonated with you. And one of the things that you bring up in the discussion about Stoicism and Epictetus's teaching is the question he asks, what can you do with a moment?
Yes. This is such an important idea to me because in these fraught times in particular, it's just the easiest thing to feel like you have no agency. Like, I mean, cynicism it's just the easiest go-to. But the thing is, if we narrow our vision down to this particular moment, which is really all that counts and all that is real,
all that we have.
Yeah. It's all that we have. And that's not just a platitude. It's real. Oops, we just lost the last one. Oops, we just lost the last. Here we are. Sharon is talking to Steve. This is it. There's nothing else. But there's everything, meaning that in any given moment, that's a fresh chance to ask ourselves, who do I want to be? What do I want to do? What do I want to give? And act and pivot accordingly. This moment can be that little point that with the slightest shift of intention or change of action or word spoken in the aggregate across time can change everything, absolutely everything. And that's not overstatement. We see that happening in our own lives, even inadvertently. We all can go back and reflect on earlier times in our lives when, you know, a so-called chance meeting with someone, or I read something in a book, and suddenly, you know, that became the person that you married, or that, you know, there's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, we all
absolutely know. Serendipity shows up in occasions like this, for sure. Yeah. And I even love the very simple questions that you just, the examples that you just gave, Sharon, and, you know, what am I doing in this moment? You know, the question of who am I? What do I want to do? What do I want to feel? Those types of questions, also, although so very simple, are so very powerful. And stopping to ask ourselves throughout any given day, what do I want to do right now? And it can really make you think, was this silly email that I felt I needed to go write, or this TV show that I thought I needed to watch, or does the floor really need sweeping, or does the laundry really have to be done? You know what? Maybe it doesn't. I think what I want to do is get out in nature today. Or yes. I think I want to call my friend who I haven't seen for a while and check up on him or her. So yes. Very powerful stuff. Agreed.
Yeah.
All right. If we can move along from your blog, I had the, and I want to tell our listeners, jump out to your website at SharonLebel.com. That's Sharon, LEBELL.com. And I'll put that in the episode notes. There's just so much wonderful information, wonderful videos, wonderful blogs that Sharon's written, and information about ordering her book, which we'll also talk about. But I'd like to touch upon a couple of your blogs that I read. And to start with, you wrote a blog called It's On Us, A Call to Radical Caring. And I love that expression, radical caring. You say, embracing our roles as citizens is to accept that the social, economic, and material conditions of our lives are not accidental, nor the result of distantly abstract policies or some bad guys out there who are making our lives a drag. Isn't that apropos sometimes? whatever is going on in our schools, towns, counties, states, provinces, countries, world, is on us to shape. Claiming our roles as citizens, rather than being spectators cackling in the peanut gallery, is radical caring. Boom. I love that. And wow, does it resonate in today's times?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. I mean, again, I think that's a very good bridge from this idea of what can you do with the moment. You can, with this moment, I can just grab a beer and sit back and just say, none of this applies to me, but then complain about everything later.
Exactly.
Or get up and, you know, write your congressperson, or deliver those muffins to the new neighbor next door. It, you know, it sounds so, what we're talking about, it sounds so, what would you call it? These actions being so small, so domestic, so
trivial, yeah.
Trivial, unexalted. But we live in this is where we live in our relationships with, we don't live inside erudite texts. We don't live inside grand gestures. We live We live in relationship to who is in front of us and what we say to them or what we do for them. And I don't know. I just can't overstate that, because if we decide to be engaged citizens, if we decide to be, if we dare to care, if we dare to care, if we, let me roll back the tape a little bit.
Sure.
I think it's so important that we appreciate how consequential our individual lives are, and to claim that. And that's not like being some monomaniacal egotist. It's just simply realizing that whatever endowments you have, whatever your situation is in life, you can use it to foster good, to make your community better, to make your world better. And but we have to, it is on us. If we don't just decide that our life matters and our gestures and our what we say.
That article so resonated with me as I read it, because I'm a sufferer of radical carinitis, and and to the point where I've taken some heat, you know, on social media over the years when there's some injustice that, you know, is going on in the world, and I can't help but speak up about it. And I think, you know, I've, you know, friends and even family members, or Steve, can you get back to, you know, pics of your travels and your dog, you know, They just don't want to hear about it. But I think it's also important that we speak out, whether it affects maybe us directly or not. And, you know, this just with this, you know, I don't want to get off on a political tangent, but just a short little, you know, footnote here that
Please.
With the Supreme Court hearings of this last week, and just being just mortified at what has happened. A quote that I just wrote this morning and posted on social media that I'll share with you is, "We all have a responsibility to call out the spear of injustice hurled at others, lest the next spear be destined for ourselves."
Yes. Thank you.
And so I think it's not only important for us to speak out and take our role in the world, but also, I mean, I don't have a uterus, for example. I'm never going to have an option of being, you know, of being pro-life or pro-choice, but I certainly want to stand up for others who I feel like their rights are being taken away. And anyway, just wanted to share that with you. But I love that. I love the whole idea of not being spectators cackling in the peanut gallery, because, you know, we are all part of the solution, and we're all part of the problem, and we have to be more engaged, I feel, and stop being spectators, for sure.
Oh yes, I'm so glad for your words, and I can only add that, well, what we're just calling, for shorthand, radical caring, being engaged. I mean, for heaven's sakes, where else does the meaning of life come from? You know, I mean, otherwise, we are just bags of meat hurling through space, reproducing and dying, and then doing it all over again. The meaning comes from caring and doing something about it. Now, that said, we can all get empathy fatigue. We can all get cared out, to be sure.
Absolutely.
And it's, we don't want to lose our ability to just sit back in wonder at life's largesse. But that's only good as far as it goes, you know. Then you want to get up and you want to make life matter. You want to make life mean. You want to point things in a good direction.
Yep. And I love the fact that you just brought up, you just mentioned the meaning of life, because you segued me perfectly into another blog that you had written called Do Small, Sensible Human Things. And I'll read a little quote from you where you talk about when you asked a friend that very question. Here's what you said. "What is the meaning of life?" I asked my friend Jan. "Oh, that's easy," she shot back. "We're here to love God, love each other, and eat pie." I love it.
Jan is so terrific.
Yeah. That may be as probably the most beautiful answer I've ever heard to the meaning of life. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, you know, you can insert, you know, for the eating pie, whatever it is that you like to eat or do, or that makes you smile for no reason whatsoever. It's just your being, and you're being joyful and having a wonderful experience. Yeah. So what, I guess my follow-up question, or my question to you for that would be, what is your pie, Sharon?
What is my pie? My pie is, no question, it's I play this weird one-of-a-kind instrument I had built for me. It's a supersized 5-octave hammer dulcimer mixed with a cymbalom, but to just help our listeners conjure a picture, it's a big trapezoidal shaped box with 106 strings, and I hit it with hammers and it makes an ethereal sound. And when I'm helping this trapezoidal box make it sound, kind of liberating it sound, I can't really put it into words, but just life makes sense to me. And I feel like I'm playing some small part in highlighting beauty and tenderness and all the things that we just don't understand, but make us tremble in a good way.
And how many strings is on that 5-octave hammer dulcimer?
It has 106 strings, and all they want to do is go out of tune. But when they're in tune, the whole world's in tune.
but is that not a little bit of a metaphor for life? All of our life, we're, you know, throughout the day, we go and we tune little things in our life. I need to do this. I want to read this book. I want to grow. I want to exercise. I want to, you know, eat right. I want to do all these little things that we're tuning and tweaking at any given time. But then we all of a sudden have these moments of euphoria when everything is in tune, everything is in harmony, and it's just pure bliss and joy.
Yes. Nothing like it. I wish that for every human being, however it comes to them.
Yep, I agree. I've talked about this on the podcast, the role that music has played in my life, and I can just be having the worst hour or day from hell and everything's going wrong, and I sit down at my piano and 10 minutes later, just all is right in the world. Music is just such a powerful anecdote to meaningless, trivial stuff in our life that gets us all worked up and upset and stressed out. It just takes us back to the essence of who we are. And that's why I think it feels so wonderful. And I agree. I wish everyone could feel it for sure.
Yeah. I have this fantasy sometimes that we would just get a whole bunch of helicopters and just drop banjos and accordions on war zones. And just people would just pick up these instruments and start playing with each other.
I love it, as naive as that sounds.
But just
no, I love it. I can see us playing music with our enemy on the battlefield instead of shooting them. And okay. You know what? It's awfully hard to shoot at someone who you've connected with on a personal level, who you've connected with musically. But in speaking of war zones, in that same blog, you bring up the British theologian C.S. Lewis, who wrote an essay on living in an atomic age. And he says, quote, "This is the first point to be made, and the first action to be taken is to pull ourselves together. If we are all going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, let that bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible and human things, praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, chatting to our friends over a pint and a game of darts, not huddled together like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. They may break our bodies, a microbe can do that, but they need not dominate our minds," end quote. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that when that bomb is coming, the human thing you'll choose to be doing is playing your dulcimer.
Yes. Yes. And I hope other people are playing golf or hugging someone, reaching out to hug someone they were afraid to, or just cooking a good meal for someone. Yeah.
Love it. All right. Switching gears, another blog that caught my attention was Faith, Belief, and Truth. And this one is more recent, where you actually talk about the January 6th insurrection.
Yes.
Or the January 6th protest or tour of the that wasn't a joke, Sharon. But anyway, you talk about the January 6th insurrection and the big lie that led to it. Yes. And you talk about how people on both sides are saying, you know, how can anyone believe that? Or how can anyone do that? And when our minds are roiled up and we are imbibing a steady stream of information, fanning our fears and mirroring our prejudices, this is you writing, it is hard to avoid having our view of the world and other people petrify. We really think we're right. We are scandalized by the behavior, beliefs, and words of others. Yet everyone else feels the same way. So, and you go on to say, since an untrained mind easily mixes up faith, belief, and truth, it is wise to practice self-scrutiny by regularly focusing our attention inward and pausing from the blaring world. Committing to practicing moral introspection grows our character and clears our thinking so that we can play our part in making a just and joyful world. I love that whole article and everything that you stated there. I'm assuming that was this article kind of percolating, or was it the kind of January 6th insurrection that kind of made that flow out of you?
It certainly, the overall belief and sentiment of the article is, well, it's a prism through which I look at the world in general, but the insurrection focused my mind on the dangers of our minds left unchecked, because it's easy for us to think that we're the clear-headed ones, we're the smart-headed ones, and they, whoever we want to deify, sure, you know, they're just nuts. But We all have cognitive bias. We all
we sure do.
Yeah. We all want to. I mean, the problem is when we step back is we do not understand really why we're even here in the world. I mean, many of us have.
Wait a minute. What about the whole pie thing we're talking about? That seems like a pretty good reason.
Well, it is, but it's an elective reason. Yeah. And all I'm driving towards is the fact that I think deep down we're all kind of scared because we don't really know what's going on and we don't really know what's going to happen. And because of that, it's our mind's tendency to just, we just are magnetized toward certainties or apparent certainties. And then we organize our identity and our worlds around these ideas and then, you know, kind of congratulate ourselves for having figured it all out. But,
sure.
We really have to watch ourselves, all of us, because this sounds so self-evident, but there's always so much more to learn. There's so much more to experience. And this is why I get really afraid of, just isms in general. Many people, for example, say, so what is it like to be a Stoic, Sharon? And I don't consider myself a Stoic. I consider myself someone who has read and continue to profit by and use the ideas in Stoicism. But I also, I had a crazy uncle who was known for his just funny aphorisms. And I learned from him too. And I think, sure. I think the thing is, as soon as we start to codify and to say, this is the way, then it's kind of human nature. Suddenly certain personalities rise to the top and become the official leaders, the official interpreters of a given faith, belief, political system, whatever. And there's just so much potential for corruption of the individual mind or the collective mind. So forgive me, I've gotten off on a bunch of tangents, but I think it's so important for us to kind of have a daily practice of making sure our minds and our hearts are open and that we're listening and looking at ourselves. All I'm saying is to watch out for complacency. That's all I'm saying, really.
I love that. And, you mentioned wonder, which we're going to talk about in a little bit here as well, that I think that is critical, Sharon. I would agree, a sense of wonder and curiosity about others who have differing opinions, differing viewpoints, and I think along those lines, I think that's so true to always try to come back to a humble place. We've all been to had situations in our life where we thought, this is right. I have the facts. I know what I'm talking about. And then somebody comes along and presents something you were completely unaware of that shows how ridiculously wrong you were. So if we've been ridiculously wrong in the past, the chances are pretty good that we will again in the future, be at some point in time. And so that's kind of a viewpoint I try to remind myself, but also that I think an exercise that works for me as well is to look and come to the understanding or consider the possibility that if I had grown up in the household of somebody in a different town or a different country or what have you, to yes. their family and their religion and their belief systems and right. and or watched their news channel or what have you, I yes. would most likely have that. In fact, I would, if I'm being really honest, have that mm-hmm. exact same. If I had their DNA, their background, their childhood, their everything, I would have their exact position. And at least that will shift me to a point of empathy, compassion, and knock down the judgment.
Right.
For sure.
Well said.
So moving along, thank you. You talk about traditional stoicism, that it posits virtue as the keystone of a well-lived life. And you talk about it, that it splits virtue into four interconnected primary components: prudence, temperance, justice, and courage. Can you kind of, I know that's a lot, but maybe in the Reader's Digest version, kind of unpack that for us a little bit.
Well, yes. So within the Stoic conception of virtue, virtue is simultaneously seen as one united aspiration of the mind and heart. But in order to grasp the notion of virtue, the traditional Stoics gave us these kind of conceptual hat racks of courage, temperance, wisdom, justice. And these facets of justice, I think, are very useful to us to keep us from seeing the notion of virtue as this, as a mere abstraction, rather than something that can be a living quality of our thoughts and our words and our deeds. Now, I have a somewhat controversial view of, or I would say an expansive view of the Stoic conception of justice. When I think of the traditional four dimensions of Stoicism, what I observe is that they are expressions of the self, that I can be courageous, that I can exercise temperance, that I can embody and foster wisdom, that I can pursue justice. And that's terrific. So I call those traditional Stoic virtues the I virtues. However, I believe, and I have many detractors about this, but I believe that in this modern world, we would do well to supplement our united sense of virtue with what I call the virtues, which I have named nurturance, liberality, altruism, and I'm forgetting the other. No, let's say nurturance, liberality, altruism, and what's the other one? But anyway, civility. And the reason why I add these is my detractors would say that these we virtue qualities are automatically entailments of the traditional virtues. But I believe we need we virtues, whatever name you call them by. It's, you know, my particular choices of name labels. It is, we needn't be attached to those. But I can't say it enough. We live in relationship. That's where life happens. And I think we need to bring to our top of mind, to the forefront of our thinking when we're considering virtue, again, say nurturance, which would be, it's the active provision of emotional and physical care and protection of other people. Liberality, the willingness to respect or accept behavior or opinions different from our own. Another way to say it is just being open to new ideas.
Sure.
Empathy. There, I just remembered my other word. Empathy. You know, that quality of being friendly, generous, and considerate. And finally, altruism, which is the selfless concern for the well-being of others. Because these we virtues, if you don't have them holding up the world, then the I virtues are kind of beside the point. You know, we need to take care of each other first, and then we have the luxury to, you know, I mean, we need to take care of each other, not least because we start out as babies and someone has to look mm-hmm. after us. So I also believe that if we overemphasize the I dimension of virtue, in other words, I am trying to get my act together, I am trying to be a better person, I think it's great, you know, self-improvement, let's just call it, you know, use a modern moniker. Self-improvement is great, but if we're only thinking about bettering the self, I think we're left kind of isolated and vulnerable.
Yeah, well, and that's interesting to me because everything you said, Sharon, makes total sense. And it seems to me if Epictetus were sitting here listening, he would be cheering you on because that seems like it's so much in alignment with so much of his teachings. So why is that considered kind of out of the norm or somewhat, you know, radical to some of your peers?
I think it's because I've dared to you know, extend out of the origin text.
I see.
You know,
okay.
It's like, well, Marcus said, Epictetus said, but, you know, we can't go by, we can't navigate our lives by purely by these origin texts. Because first of all, you know, only aristocratic men were citizens.
Seriously.
At that time.
This was, you know, like what, 150 AD, I think is
right.
When he died. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about a whole set of suppositions about the world and who counts and who doesn't, but it doesn't obtain anymore. So I think.
So it sounds to me like it's more from a standpoint of, you know, how, you know, kind of like my classical, you know, piano teacher when I was a kid, I would add little notes, you know, to some of the pieces and, you know, how dare you change what Mozart wrote or Beethoven wrote, you know, type deal. So that's probably, you know, maybe where it's coming from, you know, stick to you know, stay in your lane, Sharon. Come
right,
on, you know,
right.
That's funny. Okay. Another blog that you wrote that I loved as well, and because I just love even the title, Living as If Your Life Depended on It. And, You wrote, "We choose a philosophical life by deliberately suspending, examining, and thereby seeing the unsubstantiality and unnecessary burden of our soul's turbulence so that we can recalibrate our focus. We let go of the rope and thereby encounter ourselves and our experience from the vantage point of unencumbered wonder." There's the wonder that you mentioned earlier. Because, hey, wait a minute. Whatever our suffering, our fear, our anxiety, we remember we are alive. We were given free premium seats in the theater of life. That's amazing. Even in the midst of intense confusion, if we can still our minds with their nattering monologues, then wonder can sneak in through the back door. Wonder is the starting point of choosing a philosophical life. Just so beautifully written. And I'll put you on the spot here, but don't worry, I've got what you wrote because it's been a while since you wrote this one. You went on to talk about the first step of, you know, so for our listeners are like, how do I get to a place of wonder? I can't just, you know, so do you remember what you said is the first step?
I don't.
You wrote about in that article is being
me.
Willing. You wrote is being willing to let go of all the things we think we should know, and to, in some sense, deviate from the spirit of the long, mostly rationalistic tradition known as Western philosophy, to allow ourselves to inhabit a posture of receptivity, of listening, of being willing to be a teachable child. Also going back to what we talked about and the differences, yes. And you know, politically, wonder is where meaning can make a home for itself. Flourishing means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to and choose how you construct meaning from experience. Love
yes.
that. Anything to add to that?
Well, that puts me in mind of one of the greatest things I ever heard anyone say, the great television producer and writer, Norman Lear, who mm-hmm. is still with us. I mean, my gosh, I think he's pushing 100 years old now.
Amazing.
But he wrote a book many years ago, though he was very old at that point. It was a memoir. And the book, in documenting his life, like anyone's life, included triumphs and financial reversals and, in other words, love and pain and the whole damn thing, you know, just life, all the expressions of life. And when someone talks to him about the really painful experiences that he had across a life of giving so much joy and laughter to people through his comedy, he said, "Even this I get to experience. Even this." I love that because, okay, we just lost our house. Even this I get to experience. Okay, I've just fallen in love and I never thought it was going to be possible again. Even this I get to experience. If we take that step back and we, you know, sit in that premium seat that life has given us to watch life unfold, then even this we get to experience, and how great it is.
Yeah, and what I love about that is it's easy to say even this when it's the falling in love part. But it's a lot
exactly.
tougher when it's the, you know, I lost my house part. But what I'm sure that we can agree on is that the person who lost their house, wow, do they have an appreciation for their next house when they move in and they're in that safe space again that the rest of us don't have?
Yes. Yeah,
you better believe it.
Yes. Yes. And the opportunity to make something new. That can sound a little glib, but there's a lot that can be changed when we change our perspective.
Absolutely. What role has gratitude played in your life?
Oh, well, it's kind of saved my life, for example. Or I don't
really?
Know.
Do tell.
Well, I don't want to overstate it too much, but I, like so many people, I don't even know the right words. I battle with, I have clinical depression, and it visits me from time to time, unbidden. It has no relationship to outward circumstance. Everything can be coming up roses, and the big D will come and get me. And I make a point of saying this in public because I know there are so many quiet, silent sufferers with this. Call it a mental illness, call it an affliction, call it caring too much, whatever. But what I have found over and over again is when the big D knocks at my door, I am able to, by degrees, send it packing. By systematically, by willing myself to notice every small thing that is going well in my life. I feel a little embarrassed saying this, but we're all human beings and we all struggle. We all struggle because living is a hard thing. It's a wondrous thing, but it's a hard thing. And all I can say is that when I put myself in a frame of mind of gratitude, inch by inch, somehow I get out of mental leg irons. It just happens.
I'm so glad you shared that with us because, yeah, you are right. So many out there do and or have for certain periods in their life. I've had it creep into my life in the past, and it's, you're right, it can come up out of nowhere when even things are going well, and it can blindside you.
Yes.
And I think... But I also believe so strongly in the power of gratitude to help bring us out of it. And there's even science behind this now that there's been studies of where they give clinically depressed people some a placebo, some, you know, they tell them to do exercise, some to write in gratitude journals. And after, I think it was 15 days or 21 days, it was either 2 or 3 weeks, the ones that reported back with the greatest reduction in depression, so their mood swing improved the most, were those that were assigned the task of writing in a gratitude journal every day, writing down 4 or 5 things every day that you are thankful for. And that actually outperformed the ones that took an antidepressant.
Makes
medically
sense
induced
to me.
Antidepressants. So,
yes.
Not that there isn't a time and a place for, I think there's a lot of documentation and research that shows there's a time and a place that sometimes people are, you know, so far it is a chemical imbalance and sometimes that may be necessary. So I absolutely am not, you know, casting any judgment on anybody that has or is taking antidepressants, but there's just some strong evidence that doing that, and especially, and in fact, you talk a lot about in your teachings as well about nature. And yes. And that's another thing that plays an incredible role that I personally feel strongly that one of the huge reasons for our kind of, you know, so many of the problems that are going around in our world is that we are losing our connectivity to who we are. We're losing our connectivity to nature. And so can you talk a little bit about what role nature plays in your life as well?
Oh, gosh, it's absolutely essential.
I see beautiful trees outside your back window. We're on a Zoom call here, so it sounds like you're surrounded by nature, which I'm jealous of you for that.
I am very lucky. I live in the woods, surrounded by redwoods and Douglas firs, and so I'm able to walk outside my house and about 100 paces away are trailheads to just beautiful places. And I never take that for granted. But given that not everyone has that or even wants it for that matter, I just always say, when in doubt, go outside. Go outside. Just go outside. Take a walk. Go outside.
I agree.
You know, even
Get
outside.
I don't know that there's ever been a time in my life where I've, you know, had a bad day, an argument with somebody I care about, or what have you, where I took a walk and I feel worse after that walk. I mean, 99 out of 100 times you're going to come back and you're going to at least be calm and look at it from a more calm standpoint. But inevitably we all feel better after taking in some deep breaths, taking a walk, taking in, you know, for sure. So I totally agree with that. And that I wasn't even planning on asking you that, but since I just mentioned taking a deep breath, I thought of, does meditation play any role in your life?
Yes, it does. A daily role. I used to practice sitting meditation, a Zen form of meditation for years and years. And then I confess, I just didn't want to be sitting on my tush that long. And so, I still wanted the benefits, but I didn't want to be sitting on my tush. So I switched over to yoga. I have a daily yoga practice, which I just consider to be, meditation
as well. Yeah. Very meditative. Yeah.
And it's for me, it is utterly salvific. It's just, anytime I need, a mental adjustment, so to say, or a physical one. Actually, the beauty of it for me is that it puts me back in my body, as someone who was attracted to philosophy, I have spent a good amount of my life living from the, the neck up. And it just, when I do yoga, it reminds me how embodied our thoughts and feelings are. That when our body is relaxed and fluid, so goes the mind. I'm not being prescriptive to other people because I think everyone has to find their own practice or their own rituals that work for them. But there is something so amazing about when you build strength in your body, there's strength in your mind. I'm always astonished by this. When I have the direct experience of that connection, it's not just something, the mind-body connection thing. No, it's real. And it's fabulous.
It is. I've kind of drifted in and out over the years with where I get obsessed with yoga for, you know, 6 months, and then I, you know, don't do it regularly, but I still do it intermittently throughout my life all the time. So I would agree the benefits are spectacular for sure. But this leads us to our last signature question. What advice, Sharon, do you have for us and our listeners on how we can help make the world a better place?
Let's go back to what we were talking about in the earliest part of this conversation, where we were talking about the power, the efficacy of putatively small actions. Okay. I am a big fan of the efficacy, the influence for a better world of very, very, very small but repeated actions in the direction of good. So I'm going to give a really concrete example. It's personal. I'm not prescribing this particular action, but what I am recommending is the idea that everyone have some kind of practice, something that they do regularly so that it forms a chain going out into the future. What do I do? This is what I do. Every single day, no matter what, even if my hair is on fire, it doesn't matter. I write a handwritten note, a handwritten letter to someone, anyone. It may be someone I know, you know, maybe they're sick and I want to, you know, comfort them. Or it may be my congressperson because I'm upset about something and want to change something in the world. It might be an author whose work I have. It doesn't matter. Every day, no matter what, I write a handwritten note. Now, why do I do this? I do it not to create an effect in the world or, you know, thinking I'm going to get something from writing to someone. I do it because, first of all, I think it's so important for us to keep non-digital culture alive because it grounds us. And so for me to hand write with a pen, old fashioned, old school, it changes my frame of mind from one of just reacting to stimuli coming at me. And instead, I drop down and I think about the person to whom I'm writing. And it's kind of like a little sacred relationship. You know, I mean, I don't want to make it sound too woo-woo because it's really just writing a letter. I write the letter. I say what's in my mind, in my heart. I put a stamp on it. I happen to do this one little extra thing because I'm kind of eccentric, but it makes it more, I don't know, ceremonial, for lack of a better word. I take sealing wax and I light a match and I melt this wax on it and I put a seal on it. Completely unnecessary, but again, it just somehow enhances a sense of presence. Now you could say, oh, and then I take the letter and I put it in my outbox, which happens to just be the passenger seat of my car, because I'm going to take it to our post office later in the day. What does this have to do with changing the world? Well, first of all, it changes me. You know, I'm talking about 5 minutes. And it just takes 5 minutes to do that. Okay, 10 minutes for a really thoughtful letter.
Sure.
It changes me because I'm quiet and I'm paying attention and I'm caring. But what it does is it creates 365 connections, you know, because I do it every day with other people where they are wished well and they are appreciated and they are, you know, because in this day and age, when you receive something in your mailbox that isn't a bill or asking you to change your cable company
or junk mail, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a treat. Wow.
It's a treat. And so it's such a small action. And, you know, how quickly someone could say, you know, oh, isn't that cute? But it's very powerful. It makes people feel like their life matters. Again, not that I'm doing this in order to XYZ, sure, but it does have that effect. And it just, you know, in my little microscopic way in the world, I'm creating this nexus of relationships where there's this affirmation that people matter, that we each matter, and that we're all here to get something good done. So again, this is not my prescription for other people. We all have to find what works for us. But I really believe in small, consistent actions in service of good. They multiply. They radiate across geography, across time, and they really make a difference in a positive way, in ways that we can't ever foresee and in ways that we may never see.
Beautiful, beautiful answer, which dovetails me beautifully into the closing little excerpt I wanted to read from that same article, Living As If Your Life Depended on It. And as I read this, I'd like to bring back more of the song Shavarim Shadashim, which is Hebrew for new friends, written and played by Sharon LaBelle on her 5-octave hammer dulcimer. You wrote, "I think of duty as a sense of a covenant with ourselves, with others. All those promises we make, the ones we want to make, when we start to keep those promises, even these small ones, to ourselves and others, we move toward virtue, toward wholeness. We stop feeling like fakes and posers. We drop the ego, we drop our obsession with outcomes, and we obey our destiny." Sharon, thank you so much for being here. Wow, such beautifully said. Thank you for sharing our knowledge. As expected, I got to about half of what I wanted to cover today, but I apologize for going way over time. For our listeners, you can find out more about Sharon at SharonLaBelle.com. That's Sharon, L-E-B-E. And by the way, I should probably spell that out too. Sharon, SharonLaBelle.com. And we will put that in the episode notes. Her book that we didn't even get to, so we'll have to have you back to talk about your best-selling book, The Art of Living, the classical manual on virtue, happiness, and effectiveness. Just another excuse to invite you back, Sharon. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it meant so much. It's really been a joy. Thank you.
Special thanks to our guest, Sharon LaBelle. To learn more about her and the work she is doing, you can visit SharonLaBelle.com. Thanks to our producer, Noah Existe, and editor, Joe Tampoco. Our music was written and performed by Nadia Importante. Thank you so much for listening. If this podcast brightened your day in any way, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you have any ideas of guests or suggestions on how we can improve our show, please email us at betterplaceprojectpodcast@gmail.com. For updates on our show, you can follow us on Instagram at BetterPlaceProj or head to our website, betterplaceproject.org. Look for small ways to be kind to others this week, and that will help make the world a better place.
Make the world.